It's a kind of economic nationalism. But it relies on the mass of the working class not understanding that if they get the jobs, they're going to get the whacking of their standard of living they've never seen before. So those of you that are scared, that's exactly what you should be. People who aren't scared are not paying attention.
That's Richard Wolff, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Richard Wolff on Trumponomics. Trumponomics. Wall Street likes what it sees in the 45th president. The stock market is way up. The reality TV star heads up one of the most pro-corporate administrations in U.S. history. After railing against elites, Trump's cabinet is loaded with Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan honchos. Millionaires and billionaires are staffing key positions. It's the wealthiest cabinet in history. And deregulation of banking is high on their to-do list. Critics are calling Trump's economic policies warmed-over, trickle-down Reaganomics. Remember the slogan, "A rising tide lifts all boats"? The thing is, only the yachts go up. The canoes and rowboats sink to the bottom. The New Yorker says Trump's proposed tax cuts would greatly accentuate inequality, and his protectionist impulses, meanwhile, almost certainly won't bring back lost manufacturing jobs, but they could spark a damaging trade war. Our guest today is Richard Wolff. He's professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And he's currently visiting professor at the New School in New York. The New York Times calls him America's most prominent Marxist economist. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy at Work, and a book I did with him called Occupy the Economy. He spoke at Judson Memorial Church in New York. And now, Richard Wolff.
I have to begin, of course, and please keep this in mind, by telling you that it is difficult to be sure of what Mr. Trump is going to do. He says different things at different times. There's a difference between what he said on the campaign trail and what he's saying now. So first, he's different from other Republicans, and he's different from most Democrats, which was epitomized by the intervention around the Carrier Corporation in Indiana that I'm sure many of you read about or saw on television. So what is that? On the one hand, yes, of course, it was a photo op, it was a stunt. He got called out by the local union leader there for having wildly inflated the number of jobs he saved. All of that's true. He's a showman, he's always been a showman, he likes to do that. You really oughtn't to be surprised that he hypes what he does, he always has. A man who spends money, which I assume you all know, not to build buildings, but to pay the owners of the buildings that he can put the name Trump on the building so that the masses of people going by think it's his building when what it is his sign. There's a man who's concerned about image and hype and all the rest. On the other hand, I believe it would be a mistake not to see what is seriously going on here. And there's a lot of economics to be learned. Let's assume he carries this out. Let's assume that he is going to be shaming companies. He's done that now, not just with Carrier. He did it a little bit with Boeing. He did it a little bit with two or three other companies that you've noticed. He is going to threaten them, that's what he's done, that if you move jobs out of the United States, to Mexico is the example he's given, but jobs anywhere, at least hypothetically, there are going to be consequences. He's having meetings almost every day in Washington with businesses, businessmen and women, who represent all kinds of businesses that are worried. During the campaign, he did this to the Ford Motor Company. There was a bit of a scandal there that he asserted that Ford Motor was about to move a lot of production to Mexico, and that he had a conversation with the head of the Ford family, and the plan was dropped. But what is going on? Well, there's a number of ways to understand it. First, the political way. For most of the last 50 years, it has been the Democratic Party that positioned itself, promoted itself, as the friend of working men and women, the party that would protect you as a working person from what might otherwise happen to you if the Democrats didn't protect you and the Republicans, who are seen as the business employer party, did with you what they might otherwise have done. The Democratic Party positioned itself that way. And even when the Democratic Party didn't do all that much, it could pretty safely point to the Republicans and say to working people, that would be worse. So vote for us, the Democrats, because that would be worse. And the Democrats did it. And as the country moved to the right over the last 30, 40 years, the Democrats kept saying that they would protect working people, but they didn't do much of it. They let most of it go. They still did enough, they thought, that they could make the old claim, better us than those Republicans, and working people would support them. And then they looked at the demographics, and they saw that the number of non-white people was growing, and they would tend to vote for Democrats who promised to protect them. And the number of women entering the labor force was growing, and they also tended to look more to the Democratic Party. They looked at the demographics, they looked at the growing non-white part of the United States, they looked at all of that, and they thought they had it made. They would protect the working people, the immigrants, the women, the non-whites, and they'd win the election because that's a majority. And it was running that way. And that worked even as late as Obama. And it left the Republicans with a very dark future for themselves. They might have tried to go after the immigrants. There were some Republicans who thought you ought to try to do that. That didn't go anywhere. Maybe try to do something with African Americans. That was a real long shot. That didn't go anywhere. Try to do something with women. That didn't work either. But there was a group that they could do something about, and they did. And Mr. Trump did it more than anybody else. He fooled them and said, the very people you've always thought were in your corner, because you always presented yourself as the protector of working people, I'm going to surprise you like a sneak attack. I am going to shake up the world by saying, no, 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 I, a Republican, am going to actually do something for working people that the Democrats have been notably failures at doing. Over the last 40 years, whether the Democrats or Republicans were in, American jobs were moving to Mexico and China and everywhere else in a vast flow. The Democrats didn't do anything to stop that. Neither did the Republicans, to be sure. But the Democrats didn't. So Mr. Trump decided, I'm going to get a significant number of those working class votes by actually doing something, or at least appearing to be doing something, which is all I have to do, because I can say, even if I'm only appearing, and even if it's hyped, it's better than them, because they're not doing anything, pointing at the Democrats. This is not stupid, and this is not hype only. This is a serious maneuver which worked. Got him the election. Also, now the next question, will it continue? Will he continue? Well, partly it has to, because what he gained, he can lose in a flash. If it appears, as it already in some ways does, that these are just photo ops, it's not really going to do anything. People are going to turn on him as fast as they turn toward him. They'll turn away. If the Democrats learn, and I recognize this is a long shot, but if the Democrats learn from this, maybe he will lose it as fast as he got it. But in order for him to stay in power, and I don't just mean in the next election, but to stay in power in terms of anything he can get done, he is going to have to intervene in a kind of dramatic way, either through legislation or through public shaming of these companies. He's going to have to stop them from moving, which he is clearly, that's the way he's talking, about to do. What could happen here? Two things. One, he could fail. The traditional Republicans who never do that, who don't believe in that, who have an ideological fundamentalism that controls them, that says government should never intervene in what the private sector does, because private capitalism is, as we know, governed by the invisible hand of God. You all know the invisible hand theorem of Adam Smith. Adam Smith is the patron saint of capitalist rationalism. Adam Smith wrote, if every man, he didn't recognize the multiplicity of gender in those days, if every man pursues his own, remember, if every man pursues his own self-interest, it'll work out the best for everybody, because it's as if the self-interest of all men was guided by the invisible hand of God. Translate this into English, I mean American English. Do whatever you want, it'll all work out. You don't have to worry about anybody else. Go get it for yourself, and it'll all work out the best for everybody. This grotesque nonsense is a rationale for doing whatever you want, because you don't have to worry about the negative consequences, because there aren't any. It'll all work out. God himself is making sure. This is wonderful. So it governs a fundamentalist economics. The government should never interfere, because what each of us is doing, every business, every worker, every employer, will work out for the best for everybody. The Republicans who believe that can't have Mr. Trump directly interfering and telling a company that it may be best for you to go to Mexico, but you're not going. That's not Adam Smith. That's not even close. Wow, let's follow this a bit. You're going to intervene the way you did with the carrier company. The carrier company explained, by the way, Carrier isn't an independent company. That kind of got lost in the stories. Carrier is a subdivision of United Technologies, which is a major defense producer. Obviously, the government can tell Carrier to stop making air conditioners and to start making hot dogs, and they'll do it because they depend on the defense contracts for United Technologies, which is a parent of things like the Sikorsky helicopter and a whole bunch of other defense producers. The government can tell them what to do, but he didn't go that route, the quiet route. He went in the very public, I'm going to tell you what to do. You're not going to go where the market dictates. You're not going to make more profits in Mexico. You're not going to go where wages are. You're not going to do what a capitalist is supposed to do. I'm not going to let you. I'm going to directly interfere. That tells workers, oh, there's somebody who's doing something. That's what he needs to do. And maybe he'll get away with it. Maybe the Republicans will fold. But there are already signs, and they don't want to. Several of them have said it already. Although it took a Democratic liberal to blow everyone's mind by attacking, you're going to love this, attacking Trump for threatening capitalism, his phrase, by interfering in the market. Was this a Republican? No. It was a liberal Democrat whose name you've probably heard, Larry Summers, an advisor to Obama, an earlier advisor to Clinton. once president of Harvard, now a professor at Harvard, a liberal economist, saying that Trump, says the liberal, is violating what? Capitalism, which, as we all know, works best if the government doesn't direct. Wow! Talk about the bankruptcy of the Democrats. So maybe he'll get it. Maybe he'll do it. Maybe the Republicans will stop him. Maybe the liberal Democrats, other than Larry Sam, will wake up and stop him. But maybe they won't. And maybe he'll do it. And then let's think about that. What would happen? You can see it already with the union at Carrier. That's a union shop. The head of that union attacked Trump, but he also had to thank Trump for saving 800 jobs or whatever the actual number was. That's not good for the Democrats, to split those workers so that half of them are grateful and that's good for Mr. Trump. He doesn't have to get them all. He just has to get a good jump of them. That's how he won those states that gave him the Electoral College. That's all he needs. So maybe it'll work. And then we're going to have a really interesting thing. Then we're going to have a realignment of American politics. Then workers are going to start looking at the Democratic Party as the unreliable advocate, and the Republicans as the, then the Republicans will stay in power a very long time. And then we'll have a really interesting political alliance, won't we? A traditional Republican Party that is the party of big business, which was never able to be more than the party of big business, and therefore was always in great danger in American history. Because the party of business is the party of a minority. A tiny number of Americans are employers. Most Americans are employees. You've probably noticed that. So if you're the Republican Party, the champion of the employer, you have got an enormous problem. Or in political science, you've got no mass base. You've got no masses of people. That's why the Republican business have to go out and make alliances with some kind of mass. Like, for example, very religious people. People who don't want abortions ever, anywhere. No, not at all. People who get very wigged out if the flag is trampled on, burnt, or otherwise defaced. People who want to have 12 guns in the back of the truck that they drive. Well, it has to find and it has to bring together those masses of people. It has to make those issues enormously important, because then it can be the champion of something that will give them the mass base, without which they're the party of the employer and they're going to lose. Why are they going to lose? Because we have universal suffrage. Everybody can vote. If everybody can vote, we can all go to the polls and vote for somebody who undoes politically what those employers are trying to do economically. The mass, the power of the mass is the vote. It may not be actualized, but it's always a threat. That's why capitalists don't want a strong government. Because if the government is strong, and it's amenable to the mass of people putting their representatives in, oh boy, then we could have trouble if we're employers. Big trouble. So the mass base has to be the kind of mass base that will support the notion that the government is small and can't bug the business community, and yet feel loyal to that business community at the same time. And that's why they needed always to be allied with religious folks, patriotic folks, all of that. Gun carriers. I mean. But if they can add to that coalition, without which they couldn't survive, a significant portion of working people because they're prepared to do something, wow. And that's Trump's challenge to the Republicans. He says to them, that's what his primary race was, you are all fuddy-duddies, Mr. Bush, Mr. Rubio, Mr. Cruz, all of them. You don't get it. You keep babbling on with that Republican stuff, you're going to keep losing. You've got to come up with something new, and I got it. I'm going to get you a cut of the working class, and I'm going to do it in the only way you can, by actually doing something for them. And if you don't like it, go back to being, he loves this, losers. You're going to be losers. You were even defeated by an African American, which he told them. You're losers. You shouldn't have had that. You didn't figure it out. I'm going to figure it out. So that's his first step. He's going to be what? And that frightens folks, because that sounds like a powerful right-wing government. You got it. That's what that is. That's the whole point. Of course it is. And who's going to stop it? Nobody. Who? How? The Democrats, they don't know which way to go. The Democrats did have a chance to capture all of that. But that was Bernie Sanders. They killed that off. They killed that off. And when they killed that off, they buried themselves. Bernie was a way to take the rage of the working class and move it to the left. You cut that off, you left them only Mr. Trump. And that's where a good number, not all, of course, but a good number went. And that was all it was necessary to do. Number two, Mr. Trump is threatening to put a 35 or 45% tariff on goods coming from China. That's how it's sometimes put. Sometimes it's put a different way. Border adjustments in our tax structure. What it means is instead of taxing a company where the production happens, no matter where they sell it, you tax a company according to where the consumption of its products occurs. In other words, a company that produced in America and sold abroad wouldn't pay taxes. Only a company, wherever it was located, abroad or here, that sold in the United States, it would have to pay taxes according to how much of its product was sold in the United States. It's a different way of organizing taxation. But it has an enormously powerful effect. Every company that sells in the United States is going to have to pay big taxes. And every company that sells everywhere else has no taxes at all. That's a radical support of export industries at the expense of import industries. Now, what does that mean to all of you? It means if you have a job in an industry that exports, you're in good shape. But if you have a job in an industry that imports, you're in tough, tough shape. Your industry is going to have real serious problems. Over the last several days, the representatives of Walmart, Target, Best Buy, they're all in there, Washington, begging that this not happen because that's their business. Walmart is the outlet, I'm exaggerating, but not by much. Walmart is the outlet for the People's Republic of China. You could not have had the Chinese development of their economy, their industrialization, their producing of all the clothes you're wearing and the toaster that you make your morning breakfast with and all the rest. The only reason the Chinese could develop is because they could arrange for the sale of all of that stuff. They could not have done that at the same time that they built up their industry. They needed to have somebody else handle the selling. I'll do it, said Walmart, thereby becoming the biggest corporation in the United States because it is the agent of the People's Republic of China. They're absolutely, they have a big American flag on every Walmart, but it too was made in China. It was. Take a look. You'll see. Made in China. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to, Mr. Trump says, I'm going to make the working class in America see me boost exports from America. It'll be too expensive to bring goods in from outside. So we're going to rebuild the industry here, which is what he promised and what he's going to do as a working class Republican Party advocate. That's what he's going to do. He says, now what's going to happen? Again, we don't know. Because the enemies of all of this, Walmarts, They're mobilizing all of their people. You know another big company that brings in an enormous amount of stuff that would be hit with a terrible tax? The Koch brothers. They didn't like him anyway. Now they don't like him more. And you don't want that if you're a Republican. Now you're beginning to see the contradictions. He has to go there if the Republicans are going to survive, but if he does it, he's attacking the Republicans, or at least many of the people who support the Republican Party. How's he going to work that out? I have no idea, and I'm very sure he doesn't either. No, but that's not really a criticism. It's very hard to know. That's going to be played out now with the industries that stand to gain, siding with Trump for what he's doing, and the industries that stand to lose, pushing against him. And the question will be, how many industries spending how much money? That will determine which way this goes. For the mass of Americans, they won't be told enough to understand what the hell is going on, which is partly why I'm trying to explain it now. Taxes, in another way. He's promised to cut the corporate tax rate. In the United States, we have an official rate that corporations have to pay on their profits, a corporate profits tax. It's the official rate is 35%. So here's how it works. A company sells whatever it makes, subtracts from that amount of money, whatever it gets from selling, what it costs to produce it. The difference is the profits. And then it pays 35% of that to the federal government. That's what a corporate profits tax is. Trump has said he's going to cut it from 35, and then there's different numbers, but it's been as low as 15, sometimes 20. So a major reduction. And what's the rationale for that? It's less of a reason for companies to go abroad, where they can get away with paying lower taxes than they had to pay in the United States. Now they won't want to go so much because the United States is lowering the tax. That's the plan. Okay, what's that about? It's creating jobs, right? The idea is companies that would have gone, maybe even companies that went, will now come back since the rationale for their having gone is now removed, and they can come back and be not taxed the way they were not taxed in wherever the country is they went to. So you notice a pattern here. Whether it's jawboning a company, whether it's changing the incidence of taxation, lowering, it's all about jobs being, Mr. Trump is positioning himself as the strong provider of jobs for American working people, particularly in those parts of the country that have been savaged by the collapse of industry, which is what we call the Rust Belt or the Old Midwest, or all those, and it's all over the country, the places where the jobs disappeared. New Jersey, New York, lots of places around. Let's be honest with ourselves. He's actively doing it. Our previous presidents, Obama included, didn't. They could have, but they didn't. The Democrats didn't, and the Republicans didn't. He's doing it. And therefore, you shouldn't be surprised that he's getting all kinds of reaction because he's doing something. And we don't know how far it'll go, but wow.
You're listening to Richard Wolff on Trumponomics. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now let's explore where this is going to take us as a country. What's going on here? Well, number one, I already told you. He's violating the rule of capitalism, which is the government keeps out. That's the rule of right-wing people, of employer people, of conservative people, of Republican people. To show you how chaotic his government is, he named as the Secretary of Education a multimillionaire woman from the upper Midwest, Michigan or Minnesota, who believes that, I quote you now, that the market should govern education, that we basically shouldn't have public schools, private schools, because that's a private thing, the government's hands are out, will be better. This is an article of faith. She has worked, she and her husband, they I believe it's the Amway Corporation that made them billionaires. So they've been working on this as private citizens for a while, and now she's going to be the head of education for the whole country. She's got. So he names a person who believes that the way to go is to get the government out and let the private sector, which is what he's exactly not doing. He is intervening to create jobs. His whole career, his chief position as a Republican president is based on what he just celebrated in giving to a woman the job. And by the way, the Texas governor, in an act that really will go down among all of his extraordinary... I assume you all saw that. Mr. Perry, a man of whom even his mother once said, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And I don't mean to be mean. That's not true, I do. But you remember him from television when his campaign dissolved, when he said he was going to get rid of three departments, and he named the first, and he named the second, and he couldn't remember the third. The third one he couldn't remember is what he's now the head of. Yeah, you have to laugh because this is Woody Allen-esque. You know, or Steve Colbert. Somebody, you need a good comedian to come up with the, you named the person to run. Yeah, it's unbelievable. What? Yeah, Groucho Marx, not the other Marx. Both Marxists would have comments about this, but in a different style, in a different style. He, too, is a free market advocate, which means let the oil companies, he's from Texas, let the oil companies do their thing. So we have free market advocacy, at the same time, free market blown away by a big, powerful president who's going to tell corporations what to do. This is chaotic. This is incoherent. But it is a way of holding on to the political plan that he has, which did get him quite far, if you think about it, when nobody thought he could. So the last laugh is there. Let's follow it out. Let's suppose it works. Let's suppose he keeps the jobs from going to Mexico. Let's suppose he puts the tax on the Chinese goods coming into the United States. When I say Chinese goods, again, please remember, half, roughly, of the goods that come to the United States from China are produced by subsidiaries of American corporations. Calling them Chinese is accurate as to where they were produced and as to the nationality of the workers who made them. But the corporation that brings them here, that's an American, half of it, is an American corporation. So both the Chinese corporations and the American, if they have to pay taxes of the sort that are being described or tariffs, they are going to lose their market here. And that's Mr. Trump's idea, because if we can't afford to bring in the Chinese shirts and pants and socks we're all wearing, and iPhones that we're carrying, then we're going to have them, the ideas, produced here, because we want them, but we won't pay the price to bring them in, so we'll have American production. Well, let's follow it out. Number one. If they're produced in the United States, then they're going to have to pay American wages. The reason they went to China was to pay no wages, or excuse me, Chinese wages, which are very low. Well, if they have to pay American wages, because they're produced here, they're going to raise the price of these underpants you're wearing to the point where, I mean, you won't change them but once every month. So they last longer, and people will stay far away from you because of it. You're going to have to, your cost of living, it's going to go nuts. And what are you all going to do? You're all going to struggle, that's what people do, to raise your wages and salaries so that you can afford what it now will cost you to get a toaster, or to replace the carburetor in your car, or to buy the suit you're wearing. And yet, in the private sector, less than 7% of Americans have a union. You're not going to get rising wages that are adequate. The price is going to go up, but your income isn't. This is an assault on you. And poor Mr. Trump will be successful, perhaps, in giving more Americans jobs, even as the standard of living of all Americans goes down. And then Mr. Trump will have to worry, which way is that going to work? Will people appreciate that they have more jobs, or be enraged that the American dream is slipping even further away from any achievement at all? That is, you don't even see it discussed in the newspapers, but you ought to, because it's right there in the logic of this situation. No escape. No escape. But we're not done. Let's suppose it happens. Jobs are created in America. Chinese goods are frozen out. To do such a thing is a direct assault against the People's Republic of China. The Chinese economic miracle is 25 years of building up an industry in China, creating massive new industrial capability, creating, I don't know how many cities, brand new Chinese cities that are spectacular to see, and a rapid transportation. I mean, China is the new emerging world economy, no question about it. But it is an entire economic miracle built on exports. China made this strategic decision, very smart, back in the 1980s and 90s, that the only way to grow quickly, to industrialize, to become a power in the world, instead of the plaything of Western colonialism, which China had so long been, was to become the producer for everything in the capitalist world. That's why we're all wearing and et cetera, Chinese everything. They did it. They produced the quality at the price nobody could compete with. You close that off, what are the 400 million people that over the last 20 years left the countryside in China and moved to the coastal areas where most of their industry is located? What are you going to do with these people? You send them back into the countryside? There's nothing for them there. Leave them unemployed in the big cities? You will have a revolution in China. And no one knows that better than the leadership of the People's Republic of China. You are leaving them no option. They might try, and now you get the notion of economics, they might try to solve the problem of the United States closing itself off by dumping all the stuff they can no longer sell here in Latin America, Asia, Africa, Europe. The European economies are in such trouble, they can't handle this. What are they going to do? Close themselves off. They can't do that the way we do because they're not organized and unified enough yet. And the irony is, if Americans try to export and compete with the Chinese in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, they will beat us because they pay those wages and we pay the ones here. They can't win that way. So that'll undercut the... You get a sense of it all being blocked? Good. Too much is going on here. The odds that this is all going to work out, you got to believe Adam Smith and God's direct intervention. I don't mean to be disrespectful for those of you who think that's going on, but you'd have to rely on that. And that's an iffy proposition. You can't do that. You are declaring war on a world economy because the United States, and here I'm going to quote Mr. Bannon, you all know he's the guru behind all of this. Mr. Bannon was defending himself right after the election from the charge that he's a white supremacist, alt-right national, and all of that. He said, no, I'm not any of those things. I'm just I'm an economic nationalist. That's what his self-definition. But in a sense, I hope I've given you enough to understand that's it. That's what this is. It's a kind of economic nationalism. But it relies on the mass of the working class not understanding that if they get the jobs, they're going to get the whacking of their standard of living they've never seen before. And it also means you're not facing the risk that the trade wars that are coming, if the United States does this, have a nasty habit in human history of becoming military wars a few years later. And then we will pay in blood for this extraordinary shifting that Mr. Trump's election has begun. So those of you that are scared, that's exactly what you should be. People who aren't scared are not paying attention. That's okay. A lot of human beings handle scary things by not paying attention. There are very profound dangers in what he's doing. And the dangers are there if he's stumped and blocked by Republicans and Democrats. Because at that point, how does he survive? And how does a man like that function if his survival is being threatened? Anger, lashing out, having now surrounded himself with people who, Lord knows what they are capable of doing in the way of slowing him down or not. So if he can't get it done, there's one kind of danger. And if he does get it done, there's a whole other set of dangers. This is a sign of a system whose decline is running out of options. In mathematics, there's a theorem about degrees of freedom, how you can solve a dilemma. How many degrees of freedom have you got to work out of it? The degrees of freedom, like a trap, are shrinking for the United States. So what is solution and what does it look like? I don't think it's this or that policy. I don't think it's this or that politician. I think we're beyond that. We've tried all that. It's done. We have to make fundamental changes, and we have to be strong enough to recognize it and then to explore what the fundamental alternatives are and what they might give us. So for lack of a better term, the one I want to suggest to you is worker co-ops. Why would I pick that? Because it's a fundamentally different way of organizing production. Whether it's a factory, an office, or a store, it is a completely different way of understanding what economics is about, what you do when you go to work. It's different if you are part of a collective, of a democratic community that is engaged in production, as opposed to a hierarchical, top-down capitalist enterprise with shareholders, a board of directors, and a mass of workers. So let's begin how it might be different. Suppose a worker co-op organization of an enterprise, and it confronts a problem like people don't want to buy what we produce anymore. We make yellow shirts, and people don't like yellow, or they don't like shirts, and they now want something else. What happens in a capitalist enterprise? Well, first of all, the decision is made by the board of directors and the major shareholder. That's a tiny number of people. The mass of people have nothing to do with this. The mass of people, noticing that the shirts are not flying out of the factory, know that they have now one thing that's important to do, which is to start being very nervous about their jobs. They worry, they get anxiety attacks and panic attacks, they discover Zantac and all the 47 other ways to cope with this sort of thing, and then they worry. The decision is made by a tiny number of people. And if they can't sell, let's say, 20% anymore of those shirts, they lay off 20% of the people. They fire them. There's no point in hiring 20% of the people if the products that those 20% produce, you can't sell. So you tell those people, don't come back Monday. This is the last Friday. Good luck to you, and then you forget about them because you're busy working on your company. And then you all know how this plays out. Those 20% workers now have no income. If they have no income, they can't buy things. If they can't buy things, then the people who had jobs producing what they can no longer buy, they lose their jobs. And as this percolates through the economy, we have what's called a recession. By the way, that's where recessions come from. It's one of the ways they happen. It starts somewhere, and then it keeps going, and then we have a self-reinforcing cycle. The irrationality of capitalism is to have not intervened at the first step and said, we can avoid the big problem by doing something about those 20% of the people. Well, what would you do if you were a different economic system? You wouldn't fire them. You'd find something else for that company to do. You'd find a course that they could learn to do something else for which the demand is rising, because you'd go find that. What you would do is not fire 20%. Everybody would do 20% less work, and they would enjoy a leisure. A good thing would come out of the bad thing, because that way you could continue to pay them. You would continue to pay them, and they'd all work, but they'd do less, and their purchasing power wouldn't disappear. And you would prevent that. A rational society would never have done what we do. Because remember the logic, the mathematical logic. If people are buying 20% less shirts, then that money is likely being spent somewhere else. And that's where those workers need to go, to be moved to where the work and the demand exists. We don't do that. We handle it by a decision of an individual entrepreneur who's doing what's best for him or her, which is to lay those people. But what's best for him or her, I hate to tell you this, isn't what's best for everybody. It's not the invisible hand. It's the invisible smack in the face. And it hurts. I didn't pay this fellow to live. He pays to get me in the inlet. Okay. To say this in economic language, a worker co-op has a different set of priorities. It's not driven by profit first. It's driven by work, by the relationships of work, by the relationships among people at the work, by the larger society's well-being, all of which become part of what it is the people who run the enterprise normally think about when they make decisions. You get a different outcome because you have different goals and you have different people sitting in a different relationship to one another making the decisions. Now, I can't defend all of this in one step. But you know this is what we ought to be discussing, because if I'm right and this is a way out, we are desperately in need of a way out, because everything I told you before is we don't have a way out. Let me give you another example. Taxes. In our system, we have a fundamental contradiction in our tax structure that you have to appreciate. We have, really, employers, on the one hand, who pay a tax. Remember the 35% profits tax I told you about a few minutes ago? Employers pay a tax. And you, as working people, you pay a tax, your income tax, right? Every April, you do your taxes. Well, if you divide the society into two groups like that, and taxes have to be raised so that we have schools and hospitals and roads and all the other things that are paid for by taxes, you immediately provoke the society into an endless contest in which the businesses try to shift the tax burden onto the people and the people onto the businesses. The problem is the businesses have the resources to win, which is why all of you are screwed. You pay the taxes. Let me give you just a couple of examples. In 1946, at the end of the war, when the power of masses of people, because of the Depression and the war, really made the mass of people powerful, for every dollar raised in taxes by individual income tax, for every dollar that Washington got from individuals, it got $1.50 from corporations. In other words, corporations together paid 50% more in taxes to the government than individuals. Today, the relationship is for every dollar that is paid by individuals, you, corporations pay 25 cents. Do you understand? From $1.50 to 1 to 25 cents to 1. Over the last 50 years, the burden of taxes has been shifted off of the business community onto you. And the society is riven by that. We now have a president who says, I'm gonna cut the corporate tax massively again. Again. And that's the logic of this. You got two different groups of people, employer, employee. We want the government to give us student loans and to have a public swimming pool and to make the roads work and to have the fire department come. And corporations want the government to give them nice orders and to build the roads where the trucks are needed. Business has its demands on the government. The masses do. Business pays taxes. The masses do. This is a setup. What business is going to try to do is pay the least while the government does the most. And what we as the masses are going to do is the same thing. We're at each other's throats, whether we're publicly aware of it or not, all the time. And we are losing. You're losing. The system isn't working. That's the message here. For the first time in my life as an adult economics professor, the notion that we may be not in a society having problems, but we may be in a society dying, a particular way of earning our income is no longer viable. And that the issue is becoming more and more for all of us. Are we going to go down with this ship? Or are we going to get off and go on a different boat in a different direction? Last point. How do you do this? How would you go in a different direction? And here I'd like to make a strong plea that we think a little locally. We don't have to wait for the federal government, for the state government. We can do these things locally. We can build local worker co-op sectors of our economy to demonstrate how it's different if decisions are made democratically by workers, if the priority is jobs and security and relationships, not profits. If we aren't going to be at each other's throat about taxes, because in a worker co-op, the employer and the employee are the same people, so there's not going to be a fight, but who pays the taxes? It's all the same. Now we really deal with the question, how much taxes do we need to have the government do what we want it to do for us? These things are doable, and they're doable at a local level. Imagine if we had a mayor, a city council, local politicians, who were able to say, maybe capitalism is in such serious trouble that we have to now, not later, begin to create the alternatives so that we can see whether they work, so we can explore them, we can experience them, we can try them. We need to have worker co-ops working all over the place so that people who want a job in that kind of a situation will have a place to go and to see. And the rest of us can watch how it works and see if it gets better outcomes. You know, we spend a lot of time saying, well, there's global warming and climate change. We better do something before it gets... Yeah, well, we have the same problem with our economic system, only we can really do something here, too, if on a local basis we did it. Last point. The British are already ahead of us. The British Labour Party, the number two party in England, which may very well win in the next election, if the Labour Party wins, here's what the Labour Party is committed to. Number one. Every business in England, this will be the law, the Labour Party will push through Parliament. Any business that decides to close, that decides to move, that decides to sell itself to another company or decides to become public in the sense of selling shares, will have to give its own workers what's called a right of first refusal before they do that. In other words, the company, before it can do any of those things, will have to turn to its workers and say, you can buy the company from us and run it as a worker co-op. You become the owners, you become the directors, you're the employer and the employee. And how will the workers get the money to buy the company? The British government will lend it to them. Why? Because the British Labour Party has decided that to build a worker co-op sector of the British economy is a necessary, protective step forward for Britain in the new world of a capitalism that doesn't work real well. They say all those things. So it's not just occurring in an extraordinary church basement. It's actually out there in the open. All right, folks, we've come to the end. Thank you very much.
That was Richard Wolff on Trumponomics. He spoke at Judson Memorial Church in New York. Richard Wolff is Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and currently a visiting professor at the New School in New York. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We cover issues ignored or distorted by the corporate media. We can do that because of support from individuals just like you. We have a series of programs featuring Richard Wolff on economic issues. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Richard Wolff on Trumponomics, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.